Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday to everybody. You guys might recognize that we're drinking coffee this morning in our offices. And we have a guest today, holy smokes, from her own home office, Miss Kara North. How are you, Kara?
I'm great. How are you?
Fantastic.
Very cool. Our very first guest.
First guest ever. You're number one.
Wow, that's pretty spectacular.
Yeah. we're gonna talk academics today and transitioning maybe to the corporate world or what that looks like, instructional design stuff, maybe what the differences are, things like that. Does that sound like a good topic?
Sounds good to me.
Maybe we should start with allowing Kara to introduce herself.
Well, let's do it.
All right.
Sure. So I am Kara North. I am an instructional designer at The Ohio State University, coming up on my fifth year here at the university. Before I came to the university, I was actually an instructional designer at Amazon. So I'm actually right at the weird part where I've had 5 years of experience in corporate. Now I'm at 5 years of experience in higher ed. So it's really kind of an interesting place to be in, having both of those experiences. But like many people, I fell into this profession. I graduated undergrad in the recession, went to go work at a call center because I just wanted a job, hated it, but I got promoted rapidly into a training role, just absolutely fell in love with it. And after that, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So,
yeah. I like how you mentioned the sort of semi-accidental pathway into this world. It's always kind of cool to hear the stories of how people ended up, in training. I've often joked that you could go to the career day or whatever when you're in high school, and teaching is one of the things, but training is never something that crosses someone's radar until they're doing it, it seems. So, yeah. Yeah, Partha is chiming in. Many of us are accidental IDs. That's totally it. We all come in through different side doors, don't we? So,
I think of all the times I've asked people that, Kara can probably vouch for me too. I think maybe I've heard one person say, no, I've pretty much been on this trajectory since school, but it was a teacher to instructional designer to corporate transition, right? That they knew that's exactly what they wanted to do. Always wanted to be a teacher and then rolled right into it. I mean, obviously we have a lot of teachers who at some point decided, oh, maybe I should go corporate. There is this thing in corporate that I could do because I'm a teacher and I have all this knowledge of how to do this kind of stuff. But which I think is a little bit different, because they don't normally understand that until later in their career. Been teaching for 10 years or 5 years or whatever, and then it's like, people are making a lot more money than me out in corporate doing the same thing, and they don't have to deal with snot-nosed kids. I'm all in. So it's always an interesting pathway. So let's start with, you mentioned Amazon. Let's talk a little bit about, we'll maybe flip it and start with like your corporate side, and maybe talk a little bit about your instructional design experience there and maybe kind of what that was like. And then we'll try to make some comparisons to what you're, you know, what you've seen in academia. How does that sound?
Sure, that sounds good. So I started at Amazon and actually came in as a customer service representative at Amazon. So I got recruited from the call center that I was working at as a trainer to come over to Amazon. And it was kind of scary because the way that Amazon does their customer service is it is a temporary basis. They very rarely hire people in on the gate at a full-time associate. So I was taking a huge risk, but I figured, you know, no risk, no reward. So I went ahead and did it. And then after being there for about 3 months, they made me a full-time employee. And I told them that I was interested in getting back into training. So I was able to start doing their training for customer service and Kindle. And one thing that I was really interested in, and I went to my boss one day and I said, who makes this garbage? I'm sorry, because it just wasn't fitting what the people needed. The Kindle stuff had not been updated for a while. There were associates that were taking what they were supposed to do as far as, they called them wizards. So basically when you troubleshoot a Kindle, the steps, they were cutting through shortcuts because they found like that wasn't really valuable. And I said, you know, this isn't how people actually do the work. And I want to know how this can get updated, what I can do to fix it. And he said, well, funny you should ask. The instructional design team is really overworked right now and they could probably use some help. Would you be interested in that position? And I said, sure. So I became an instructional designer before I knew anything about it at all. So my big mouth got me into trouble, I guess. But what was great about it is at the time, I was one of seven. This was in 2009. So I was one of seven that did all like the North America and customer service. So the stuff that we built were used in, you know, North America, Costa Rica, was used in the Philippines, India. So that was pretty powerful that the stuff that I was making was seen worldwide. But I got to do a bunch of awesome stuff. Specifically, that's when I started my love-hate relationship with learning management systems. I would help the training folks get their classes set up in the learning management system. I'd help troubleshoot some issues with the different courses. I was able to build courses. And one thing that I really love to do is because my office was in the call center, I was able to like work with the actual associates on the phone, sit with them. I love taking calls. I know that that's kind of unorthodox, but I think it's so important to understand what people were facing and what kind of contacts were they getting on the phone. And I feel like that made me a better instructional designer, understand a little bit more about their needs and how they navigate the system and where they go look for things. So I loved my job and my time there. But then I fell in love with a guy in Ohio and I got imported up here and I started my journey at The Ohio State University.
Hmm. Perfect. Chris, you have any questions for her about the corporate side of things?
So the training that you were, or the instructional design work that you were doing, that was for, because you mentioned, you know, supporting the Kindle, but that was for actual employees dealing with at the customer service level, not Kindle related stuff for end users.
I did a lot of stuff, okay. Actually. So most of it was for the customer service associates, and that's including phone, chat, and email support. I did Amazon.com, which is, you know, product knowledge, where's my stuff, that kind of stuff. But then I was also part of the Kindle Fire launch team. So they launched Kindle Fire during my tenure there, and I was able to help assist the product team with getting stuff out there. But it was just kind of a hodgepodge of everything. There was a specific sector of the ID team that worked on the help pages. So they would build up customer-facing resources. But then there was a sector of the team that would focus on associate resources, and I was more in the associate bucket.
Cool. And that's kind of, that's somewhat unique because a lot of folks are just internal only, like training employees, but you know, that crossing of not just internal, but external clients or external users and stuff too. Sounds like you had a good opportunity for both those types of experiences. That's cool.
Yeah. And the nice thing about Amazon in general, and I'm sure they still do this, is they put a lot of trust in their associates. So if you contact Amazon for an issue, that associate doesn't usually have to go through multiple layers of approval to make your situation right. They have the authorization to give you a gift card if you need it or replace that product that you got lost, that kind of stuff. So with that great power obviously comes great responsibilities. So making sure that they are well supported, knowing exactly where they need to go to for different products, that is instrumental. And a lot of associates didn't get it until they got that call with somebody lost a MacBook Pro. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's a big machine. Can I, you know, replace that? And most of the time they could without going through a supervisor and all that. So giving them the knowledge and the skills to understand where to go to make sure that that is following policy, plus also giving them the power to say, hey, I saw this in the knowledge center. It's not really jiving with me. How can I, you know, make this better? We were able to also empower the users if they had any questions about anything. There's a button on all the stuff that we did. Please let us know if there's something wrong with it. And then that way they could also be a part of that process and make it better for everyone.
Which that's very cool.
Can I call to get that MacBook Pro resend? And you know what? So this is so before we jump over to the academic side, let me ask one additional question. What was that like to move into that instructional design role, not really knowing what you were getting into, not really going into it? Did like were the people already in that role? Were they accepting of you? Did they coach you? Did they were they were, you know, was there any sort of like butting of heads or, you know, I mean, not to call anybody out or anything, but, you know, you don't have to go to the go negative on it or anything, because it does sound like a great experience. But I'm just curious what that felt like, because we like to overcomplicate instructional design. And for somebody to just sort of step into it and start doing the work of it, you know, I always wonder what that feels like.
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing that I was very pleased with in my time at Amazon is I had fantastic support. My actual boss was in Seattle, and I was at a desk in Huntington, West Virginia, in one of the call centers. So I knew if I needed anything, I could contact my boss for any kind of information that I needed. But most of the instructional designers at the time, at least on my team, came from what we call the trenches. They were on the phones. They were trainers. So they had that institutional knowledge of Amazon, and they had been there for so long that they loved the fact that I was fresh off the phones and I had that experience coming in, and they were able to really talk to me about what's going on, what are some of the issues that the associates are having. So I didn't really have that big of a, not really a battle, but I didn't really have any conflict with that. But I will say, before I was leaving, I saw that they were starting to hire people that didn't have that experience. So people, you know, just straight in as instructional designers. And I saw that kind of being more of an issue, because so many of us were used to having that experience on the phones. And then, you know, part of their onboarding was they had to sit with a customer service associate for a day. And we're like, a day, like, you know, the day's nothing, you know, that you there's way more stuff going on, especially during Q4 when it's the holiday season and it's chaotic and everybody gets a Kindle for their grandparents and their grandparents don't know what their Wi-Fi password is and they contact us. And that's where it really gets interesting. But I will say that I was very blessed, and I always like to say that this is part of the reason why I was kind of a late adopter to Twitter, because I had such a great network in Amazon, and I still talk to a lot of my former coworkers on a day-to-day basis. So having that team, having that support was really integral. But then when I came to higher ed, I found that I didn't have that. So this is probably a good segue into the higher ed piece.
Nicely done, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about, we'll circle back to what you were just mentioning there, but tell us a little bit about what you do now at the university.
Okay, so at the university, there are, the university is, I guess, chopped up into different units. So some of us are in particular colleges and we're instructional designers. And then we have an overarching, governing body, but there is an overarching group called the Department of Education and E-Learning. And these are the folks that focus solely on like the online offering. So our online only programs at the university, they're the folks that put those together, and they're currently going through a really neat process. Starting in the fall, we have a project called Digital Flagship. So every incoming freshman at The Ohio State University will get an iPad Pro with an Apple Pencil, and they're going to be given coding lessons, and all of the professors are kind of expected to really start integrating iPads into the classroom. And we've seen that several of the classes for the fall actually say that students need an iPad for the course. So that's something kind of completely new for the university. But in my particular sector, I am in a research center that's part of the College of Education. And a lot of the things that I do a lot of project work. A lot of the things that I build is more for professional development or federal or state grants, that kind of stuff. A lot of stuff that I build personally is not seen academically. But with that being said, you never know. I mean, I like to shake things up. I like change. And I've been in this position for a couple of years. So, I mean, who's to say in the next year or two, I don't move into a more academic facing position. But for now, that's kind of where I'm at.
Cool. I've noticed that in academic institutions, there does tend to be sort of two tracks of instructional designers or different types of jobs you can do. There's the instructional design team that helps train the staff, right? Traditional, almost similar to the types of things that corporate training people need to do. And then there's the instructional design teams that help design or redesign the actual classes, and they work with the instructors and try to craft better experiences for the students and all of that. And I'm sure that kind of falls under the, you know, teaching, okay, how are we going to integrate these iPads and all of that kind of stuff. And so which camp do you sort of fall into,
or
do you
do the first one? Usually the first one. So again, more of the staff development and then the different projects that we work on. So for example, one of the paramount projects I work on here is we have, and when I say we, I mean my center at Ohio State, has a contract with the Ohio Department of Education, and we build end of course exams for career technical test in the state of Ohio. So in the state of Ohio, if you're in a career technical course, you are mandated to take an end of course exam to show what you've learned in that particular course, whether it's family consumer sciences, agriculture, IT, welding, etc. We write those tests. So a lot of my job's actually more facilitation and more instructor led, where I work with teachers from all across the state of Ohio to write these test questions and then put them through quality assurance to make sure that these test questions are good and they really fit the breadth of the course standard for the particular course. And then that way the students have the best opportunity to really demonstrate that knowledge transfer that they got in that course.
Cool. Chris, I'm sorry, I think I interrupted you there.
Well, actually, I was starting to say the exact same thing, noting that sort of dual aspect in, you know, of working with internal staff and versus actual new programs for students enrolled in the system, that same sort of double structure that we would in the academic world. So we were thinking the same thing at the same time, Brent.
You're totally connected. We've got the mind meld going.
Yeah. So
what did you mentioned your love-hate relationship with LMSs earlier when you were introducing yourself, that it sort of did that start at Amazon, you said, or did that start at in academia, and what are like the differences, right? I'm assuming Ohio State has an LMS and obviously Amazon had theirs. Like, give us a little compare and contrast of sort of what those headaches were that were caused.
Sure. So at Amazon, part of your role as an instructional designer, at least in my unit, was we worked out of a LMS queue. So essentially, we just had an inbox of people that would make complaints about either a course or a curriculum in the LMS. And it was literally like problem solving, which I did like when it was something that I could solve, but I absolutely could not stand it when I couldn't solve it. And I think that's where the love-hate relationship really kind of came, because I wanted to solve that for that trainer or that learner. I wanted to fix their problem, but then having to file a ticket and then go through the wrap-up process and keep sharing updates with them, I mean, I feel like that was really disappointing, because I kept thinking, you know, if this is your first day at Amazon and you're trying to take this course to onboard to do your job and it's not working, what is that saying about the company? I really cared about the reputation of the company and got really mad at the LMS whenever I felt like it kind of messed that up. Now, again, one LMS to rule them all at Amazon, but come here to Ohio State, we have multiple LMSs, multiple. So we have an LMS just for the academic facing courses. And then we have a separate LMS for the professional development, the staff development. And those two don't talk to each other. Those two don't like each other. They are just day and night in just multiple ways. So the academic one, I feel like, is a little bit more sleeker. It's prettier to look at, so aesthetically it's easier to kind of find your stuff. The one for the staff I can't tell you how many different job aids and trainings that have happened just to help people find what they're looking for. One of the silliest things that that thing does is as soon as a course is completed, it goes to like an archive on their transcript. So one of the first questions is, I took this course and I need to show my manager that I finished this course and I can't find it. What is wrong with it? And then you're like, oh, you have to click the archive and there it is. Silliest thing ever. And again, I think that it's all about the user experience, right? So the students, I feel like, have very high expectations, especially if they're in an online-only program. You think about that. That is like their only interaction with their professor and their peers. So it better be very clear to understand where they need to go and where they get their information. One thing I think that Ohio State does a really nice job with is it is a Quality Matters institution, meaning that they try to make sure that all the online courses get that 85% threshold of Quality Matters score, meaning that it's accessible, it's easy to navigate, and it has all the information that a student currently needs, plus future. So this is, do you need IT support? You need to contact this person. Do you need help with maybe setting an accommodation? You contact this person. So really making sure that that student is supported as well as if they were physically located on this campus is something that I feel like Ohio State does a great job in their academic courses. But again, the professional development LMS, I feel like that thing is the wild, wild west. I mean, it's really difficult to use. And I think a lot of times that staff members don't have a lot of time to take professional development. And then if they're going in there and they're fumbling around to try to find something, they're likely probably not going to take something, even though there might be some really good content out there.
Yeah. From the, on the student experience, I mean, there's a lot of stress involved in being a student. And so it sounds like the university does a good job, at least of ameliorating that. My daughter is in a university program and was, it was a classroom session, but she was submitting, I think, an essay or something online earlier this spring. And we happened to be texting with her at the time. And I mean, basically everybody in the 101 psychology class was submitting their essays at the same time.
Oh, gosh.
So she had to try multiple times because basically I think the server just wasn't prepared to handle the fact that Sunday at midnight, 500 people are going to push the upload button, you know? So,
yeah. That last minute project upload for the final projects, like end of semester, those servers are probably smoking like for the last week, everybody turning in their final projects and all that.
We had the organizational world, one of the earlier projects that going way back to maybe my second year in this biz, but anyway, it was a government, one of the sort of annual IT securities, right? Everybody had to do it every year. I agree not to do this and that. And basically the expectation was that tens of thousands of people were all going to take it on the last day. And so the servers needed, you know, but they, at least they recognized that human nature being what it is, you know, that the server load had to be able to accept that. So anyway.
I'll just put that in your RFP, right?
It's yeah.
Not how many can it handle over time. It's how many people can it handle on that day before projects are due for everyone.
Yeah. So
actually, so, speak.
Give us a couple, maybe. Let's go with similarities first, and then maybe some differences of being an instructional designer in each of those environments: academic versus corporate. Just, I mean, right off the top of your head, you know, it doesn't have to be anything crazy.
Okay. So similarities for sure, dealing with difficult clients. I mean, you're going to have that in corporate and you think your SMEs are difficult, try working with a college professor. Okay. It can get a little tense, but I will say that I found that there's kind of two buckets. There's ones that are really encouraging and really want the help. They really want to take their content to the next level and reach different populations of students. But then there's some that this is my content, back off, buddy. I don't want to have anything to do with you kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I do think that that is obviously key. Another big thing is you got to keep upskilling yourself. You got to stay invested in yourself. And even if your company doesn't necessarily provide that, you're doing a huge disservice to yourself if you're not keeping up with the current skills, trying new things, trying to figure out what works well for your training population. And that's for students. And then obviously that's for your training population in corporate. And I would also say that just figuring out what are some mediums and tools that you can use that, I hate to say evergreen, but things that, like, let's say something happened to where you had to pass a project off to somebody. Would that make sense to someone else if you passed off your content, passed off your assets, that kind of stuff? So that is very critical, especially in higher education. So I feel like this is a big difference. What you build in corporate, obviously that works just for that organization. One thing that I've learned at my job at Ohio State is that a government dollar is any color but green. So they have a lot of different things and rules that we have to abide by at Ohio State when we build curriculum. So we really have to focus on ADA compliance. We have to focus on making sure that we use everything that is cited appropriately. You know, that all that stuff really comes into play, because who knows how many eyeballs are going to see what is built here at Ohio State. And it just takes one complaint to really undermine a whole program. So really being critical and careful with that is something I kind of had to get used to when I came here, because at Amazon, they enjoyed the creativity, the humor, that kind of stuff. And you can still infuse that in your projects here at Ohio State, but you just have to be a little bit more intentional when you think about it. I would say another difference is, again, just focusing on the change of the population. So in a training environment, a lot of times you kind of know what the people are going to be doing. But in an education environment, especially if it's a general education class, if it's a philosophy class, so to speak, you have to make content broad to where it appeals to everyone, because you don't know what they're going to be doing with the content at the end of the day. You don't know if they're going to be a philosophy scholar, or if they're going to go to medical school, or if they're going to go to law school. So really focusing on making it as accessible, and when I say accessible, just fun and interesting for as many different people, I think is super, super, super important. Music notes. That's fun.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. All the stuff you learn. I think, you know, that's one of the fun things. One of the reasons why I love this job is that you're always getting to learn new stuff. So with every new project, it's something new to learn. You have to be curious enough to want to learn all the topics that you're building training for. And, but I don't want to let this go by without us commenting on it, but the ADA part that you mentioned, I think is a really big differentiator, because in my experiences, universities, government agencies are way more focused on that being just a mandatory thing. Like, that's way more front of mind than in corporate, right? Unless there is a very, very specific product reason or company reason, or there's somebody in the company that is aware of it and they really want all of the training to be very much centered around that. It's more of an afterthought, right? In academia and in government institutions, it's the first thought. How do we make sure that it meets all of these compliances? And I think, wasn't there recently an upgrade? Did we have a conversation about this yet once? Maybe we should schedule that as a topic too, because I think it's a really good topic for us to talk about in our industry, because I don't think it gets enough. It doesn't get enough coverage. 508C, I think, is the
government. Yeah, ADA 508C. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's apparently a new version coming out, or that is out.
With the HTML5, I think. Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah, I think there's something. It's called like H2 or something like that, or I'm just making that up, but it's shorter than it's 508C, whatever it is, but it's like version. Daniel, I'm just making stuff up. I don't want to confuse people, but it's important for us to talk about later. That was the note I wanted to say.
Absolutely. Sounds like a critical thing that we should be talking about. I know definitely, you know, in terms of people that we talk to, it is very much more of a focus for you know, organizations from a government type, you know, background perspective, that's always, you know, a critical thing. But kudos to the rest of the world, because we are finding more and more that it is important, and it's being brought up in the conversation, pre-sales process or whatever, that, okay, how do you guys support accessibility with like more corporate type of, you know, client team? So it is something that I think has a growing and improving recognition, but still not always top of mind for folks outside of the government or academic kind of world. So, yeah.
I thought of another distinction really quickly. So cool. When I was at Amazon, obviously I was a worker bee and I got stuff done, and that was kind of the end of it. But at the university, I'm able to really work in scholarship. And what I mean by that is I can help with research studies that professors are doing. I can help set up those kind of test groups. I can talk about what was worked for me as an instructional designer and get feedback on that. So there's those rich partnerships that you can make with the academic community, to where you can kind of become a thought leader and you can kind of be known as the instructional designer at your institution. That's pretty powerful. And that is certainly a platform that I didn't expect when I came here, but it's something that I'm starting to understand a little bit more, and I hope to take full advantage of it in the future. So just being able to not only work in what I do, but then sharing that with other institutions and sharing those best practices. A lot of times you have to do it in some kind of a research, or it doesn't get across as well. And you'll know that if you ever go to an academic conference, I'm sorry, they focus so much on the research, but they really miss that practical application. Never forget the first time I went to an academic conference. I was like, okay, yeah, so what? And they're like, oh, that's it. It's like, what? You didn't build something? You didn't do something with it? But that's just kind of the language that they speak.
Involved, and then we wrote some stuff about it, and then we thought some more, and then we wrote some stuff about it, and then we talked about it together, had some peers review it, but no, we don't build things. No. I think that's
one of the things one of the things I was wondering as we came into this today, Kara, were just like from the more instructional designy kind of angle, how, you know, having bridged both of those worlds, are there instructional design either tips or techniques that you've gathered from the academic world that you think maybe the corporate world should be, you know, incorporating in into the learning process? Are there things that, you know, we can take from one world and improve what we do in the other world?
I think the biggest one, Chris, is I almost exclusively do rapid prototyping now. And I didn't necessarily do that in the corporate world, because I was given a certain subject to build on. And then it's like, you know, get work with the subject matter expert, get the content, and then whatever you build, like, you know, show us a storyboard, that kind of thing. I find that I have been building just like different interactions, different kind of video intros, video outros. So really focusing on these artifacts where they can actually see it is important, and it saves you a lot of time in academic, because you do have to focus on getting your images, getting your music, getting all that with the, you know, that's properly cited, and it's Creative Commons and all of that. So making sure that you have all that on the front end saves you so much time than after the storyboard is completed, and then you're trying to find those digital assets that you can share.
That's really cool, because it actually comes from my mind, the idea of rapid prototyping would be something that in the, at least in the tech culture of, you know, build it, break it, fix it, you know, seems more aligned with that kind of, you know, philosophy. But to hear that that's actually in the academic world, that where you're actually, you know, being applying that more directly, that's really kind of neat. That's a different twist. I wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah, I was expecting the opposite as well, that the school might be a little bit more bureaucratic. There might be a lot more hoops to jump through. You got to get a lot of approvals from different people to do certain projects. And, you know, it's more of a 6-month sort of development process before you can actually get to, you know, creating something. And the corporates maybe were moving a little bit more quickly. But that's an
I thought that was a given. I didn't think I had to say that on camera.
Yeah, you always have to deal with the bureaucracy a little bit, but I'm sure you had to deal with that in both places.
Sure. Yeah, I recently, my friend Myra does a thing called Myra Monday, and she actually asked a question this past Monday, what was your biggest like war story or what was your biggest kind of failure? And I'll never forget this as long as I live, but it was my first solo project in Amazon. And I had this really enthusiastic project manager talking about this app for Q4 Amazon Santa, which was essentially a wish list app where the child made a wish list and it sent this letter to Santa, but then, you know, mom and dad got the wish list of what they wanted. This guy was like, this is going to be huge. This is so important. And people, you know, the grandparents are really going to latch onto this. We really have to have training. And Q4 is nuts. I mean, it's usually mandatory overtime. It's a blackout period. People can't take off work. I mean, you're expected to be there because there's just so many volumes of contacts during that holiday season. And I made a mandatory 15-minute training on it. Mandatory. So I took probably 8 to 10,000 associates out of their work queue for 15 minutes to take this wish list training. And it ended up being less than 0.5% of the contacts for Q4. I was scared to death to talk to my manager. I was sweating and I was like, I'm going to get fired. I mean, I thought my head was going to be on a platter. I really did. And she told me that and I expected it. I knew it was coming. And I said, you know, I'm so sorry. I said, what could I have done better? And she said, did you tell the guy no? I was like, no, I didn't tell him no. He's 6 levels above me in the company. You know, I'm not going to tell that guy no. And she said, you got to have a backbone. She said, you are the process expert. You know what you're doing as far as this piece goes. It's great that he's enthusiastic, but I said, you should have really stood up to him. And I'll never forget that. And I've never been an order taker since.
That's a fantastic story. I love that. Yeah, that is really, really cool, man. Yeah, I think everybody, you know, yeah, it's nice that it's nice that you're able to step into a first project role like that and struggle, and have your manager, your senior leader, you know, give you that kind of advice early on in your career, because it does stick like crazy. Those early projects are really, really critical for people. And I think more of management needs to realize that, especially as they hire new people onto their teams, especially if what they're hiring is somebody fresh out of school, or maybe somebody in your case that didn't even have any instructional design background. This is their first attempt at owning a project and doing this kind of thing. To give that kind of really practical advice, I think is wonderful.
Well, it brings to mind the question that sometimes gets asked, you know, is a course, you know, really necessary when someone comes and says, we need a course on something, and not everybody who's in the training department even feels empowered to be able to even ask that question, you know, because you're feel like you're being given marching orders or here's the thing. But our expertise really is to maybe sit back and evaluate and say, is this a valid use of people's time? Is this important, or, you know, can it be different, or what have you? So,
and not getting real deep in the rabbit hole, but I think it's even more challenging when you are 22 years old and a female in a company like that, when you're talking to a tech guy that has been with the company ever since it was in a garage. I mean, that's really intimidating, right?
Yeah.
Well, as you said, you know, X number of levels above you in the hierarchy chart too. That's a lot to negotiate there, for sure.
But it's cool that your manager was living the Amazon values, right? And giving you that kind of coaching, saying, you know what, it doesn't matter how many levels above you that guy was. If you didn't think this was the right thing to be doing, you have the authority to question that request, at the very least push back a little bit, you know, which is great. It is neat. Good, but yeah, hard. I'm certain. I'm not,
that's a heck of a,
don't get me wrong, yeah. I'm not, you know, it is not easy, especially like at that age. I don't think I would have just said, yeah, okay, cool, we'll do that. Uh-huh. No problem.
Yep, they say jump and we just say how high. So yeah,
we should figure you
I'm looking down at the clock, guys, and we are, not surprisingly, a little bit over, but it's been fabulous conversation. Anything else from your side, Kara, that you're thinking about, you know, that might be able to help people transition?
Again, I cannot emphasize the importance of networking. I wish that's something I would have done earlier in my career, but I like to think that I'm making up for it at a rapid pace. So really get into these groups, focus on building relationships with people on Twitter. Most people in this industry are very nice people and they want to help you succeed, and you can share your knowledge with them and they can share their knowledge with you. And you can really, really build a lot of great skills just from your relationships with other people, just trying something different and seeing if it works for you.
That's brilliant advice, no matter where anybody is in their career,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, cool. For sure.
Well, I hear the music. Brent will play us out. Thanks, Kara, so much. This has
my
been
pleasure. Thank
fabulous.
You.
Yeah, hey, you know what? Before we do go, though, where can people find you on Twitter?
I'll put it in the chat. I'm on Twitter at KaraNorth11, or my website is KaraNorth.com.
Awesome.
Cool.
Thanks, Kara.
Thank
Great
you.
To see you. Always good to see you too, Chris. Thank you.